Reading through the history of art, I stumbled upon the art of the late 20th and early 21st centuries. In the section, I noticed what I thought was a picture of colored pencils. The artwork entitled Pencils, literally just pencils, by Guerino Boato, was a picture of colored pencils, some of which were sharp, some of which were dull, some of which were bright colored, some of which were dark colored. The work represented a still life shot taken by a macro lens. Some areas in the image were blurry, while other areas in the image were sharp. I, following my cousin's ineffable wisdom, as he says himself, viewed that example as contemporary art. For days, without researching the piece itself, I considered the image just a photograph of pencils. A photograph that would take me maybe at most 15 minutes to replicate. And the 15 minutes will be spent dulling out some of the pencils that I recently bought from Walmart. And then I would just take the picture and that would be it. Little did I know that my impetuous, my extremely impulsive conclusion was not correct. Not even correct or injudicious. My conclusion was injudicious. The artwork was not a photograph. It wasn't a photograph. It was actually a painting. When I went back to laugh at the obscenity of contemporary art and contemporary art, I noticed a word under pencils: acrylic. I was shocked to find that the artist created extremely realistic paintings, including pencils that seem to resemble photographs. The art style is referred to as hyperrealism. Pencils was acrylic paint on a board, not a photograph. Upon realizing this, not only was I mesmerized, I was just... I felt very stupid and very shocked. I was like, oh. Because I honestly had the same opinion. I went to the Baltimore Museum of Art and looked through the contemporary art, and I could not stand it. I mean, I was with two other people that couldn't understand, or that couldn't stand it either, so I understand why I may have thought that way. But still, I just could not stand contemporary art, and I found every single reason possible to make fun of it. And then I got tricked. Contemporary art tricked me. Realizing the futility of my judgment, I began to analyze the painting. In a short time, I actually began to develop quite a distinct examination of the colors of the pencils, and specifically the highlight of the painting, which was a dull blue pencil. I like to go a little crazy with my analyses. I'm not saying this is right. It probably isn't right. It almost undoubtedly is not right. I don't want it to necessarily be right, but it's how I think of it, right? That's how you should analyze art, personally. I don't want to analyze something for it to be correct. I want to analyze it to fit what I want to learn from it. Or, like, I want it to change me, to kind of represent something to me, not to the person who believes that literature and artwork is logical. High culture is not logical. It is empathy. It is sympathy. It is an emotion, not a logic. It is pathos, not logos, as Aristotle may say. But this is not necessarily rhetoric. Even so, I thought that the many different colors and sharpnesses of the pencils represented to me the diversity of humans, and especially of the United States. But no, it has nothing to do with the United States. But I thought it represented diversity because you had all these different colors, light colors, dark colors, blue colors, purple colors, green colors, yellow colors. Everything was different. There were dull and sharp pencils alongside one another, and they seemed to live in at least relative harmony. But the pencils are not also they're not organized by color or sharpness, but they simply exist alongside one another, potentially hinting at the beauty of coexistence. In my opinion, again, I found my strongest examination in the blue pencil in the middle. Unfortunately, it had nothing to do with my former analysis. The blue pencil, while the focus of the painting, is dull itself, being duller than quite a number of pencils around it, than several pencils around it, all of which are not in focus. My examination of this point was quite ambitious, and I have had more. This is nothing. I'll tell a story. When I was at my cousin's house back in July, I was analyzing one of the artworks he had on his wall. It was a very large abstract painting, and I went way too far with it. I saw an old man with a long beard, potentially representing wiseness and intellect. And I went as far as to be like, maybe my cousin, who is a completely separate being and who had a completely different analysis of it, maybe he thought that this would represent, or like this would, the painting represented what he wanted to be, potentially, like he wanted to be wise, because he is my mentor, and you could obviously say that he is wise because he is my mentor. Of course, mentors are generally wise, so I assumed that maybe it exemplified that he wanted to become that kind of person, or that he was proud of himself for being that kind of person. And I went very far with it because he had a completely different idea. And that's when like, it's like, okay, slow down the analysis quickly, because there is such thing as too far, but always go as far as you can. Keep it to yourself, but go as far as you can. I actually really did like that analysis, but it doesn't mean it's necessarily true. An analysis, if you're doing a personal analysis, it's more philosophical than it is correct. It is more emotional than it is correct. There's no reason for you to make sure that your ideas of the moral of a story or the moral of a picture or what a specific quality of a picture exemplifies. It is not your job to make sure that it is correct. It is your job to make sure that it fits you. That's the thing about art. That's the thing about anything in high culture. It's supposed to represent yourself. It's supposed to represent your own growth, not someone else's growth, not the most logical form of growth. Because we are not Thomas Gradgrind from Hard Times by Charles Dickens. We are not fact, fact, fact. You have to blend fact and emotion together, because we are, in the end, humans. But yeah, off of that, the blue pencil was duller than a number of pencils around it. My examination of this point was ambitious, as I said. So I guessed maybe the blue pencil and its dullness represents the leaders of our societies, the politicians and the CEOs and the professional athletes and the scientists and the journalists. It may represent that they're not perfect. They may not be the people we think they are. We blame the president, for example, for everything that happens. We excoriate the president when he, or potentially in the future, she does something wrong. And whenever he or she does something right, we worship them. And that's, first of all, no president is perfect. And second of all, no president is imperfect. So it can go both ways in a very bad way. Let's just say it that way. So the president is just one example. There are numerous examples everywhere. Every leader in our society is excoriated more than he should be, more than he or she should be. Every leader in our society is not perfect. They're still humans. I think we kind of idealize the people that seem to be above us because they are at the top. They make $1 billion a year. They have 10 million Instagram followers. They are extremely good orators. They know what they're doing with politics. They're able to rally hundreds of thousands of people. But in the end, they're still humans. So if they do something wrong, they're still humans. You can't blame them as if they're an alien, because they're still just humans. They're still people. They're still just like you and I. I mean, we share so much DNA together, you and I, and every single one of us. No matter what skin color, race, ideology, whatever we are, we all share very similar characteristics. So to idealize someone at the top and almost not understand that they're not perfect is not only impertinent, but kind of ignorant. And it's a natural thing. It's just typical human ignorance, because I think we all do that. But it is, of course, somewhat of a problem. It is impertinent. And I can think of Simone Biles as an example. I mean, she got some serious criticism for that, even though we need to understand that she is still human. She still has emotional issues, because every human has emotional issues. Every human is emotional. Every human has problems and follies and deceits and maledictive characteristics. That's maledictive is not the right word, but still, you understand what I mean. But that's basically what I got out of it. So I got a pretty ambitious analysis from that tiny picture, the tiny painting of pencils. So there you go. But we must understand that the leaders of our societies are humans, just like us, as I said. And we must understand that to criticize our leaders for faulty policy and incorrect moves, not personal dispositions, is a better way than is a better thing to do than to just criticize them for everything, for the people they are. We must learn to criticize them for their policy only and not question their personal humanity. Because in the end, most of our leaders have humanity. I mean, there are a few exceptions, and for those of you that know about what year it was last year, you probably know the person I'm speaking of. But there generally are not that many exceptions. Most of us are still good people. Most of us are still good leaders. They're just, everyone has different opinions, right? But anyway, one could simply look at pencils and awe at its masterful craft, which was probably what it was intended for. And you can worry not about its minute details and symbols. In this episode and these two episodes, the interesting and ever more complex movements, because they're more diverse and spread out over much larger areas, these more complex movements in modern art, art from 1770 to the present, will be examined. So we'll start with modern art, of course, because we're doing modern art. But we'll start with just simply introducing the section, then we'll go to Romanticism and all the many amazing movements of modern art. With the Age of Enlightenment, the revolutions in America and France, and the First Industrial Revolution, distances became shorter and movements more rapid. The invention of photography created many entirely new art forms, such as photographic portraiture, modeling, and later as in when photography became more accessible, still life photography, and even astrophotography, which is my favorite form of photography. And if you've seen my Astrobin page, you will know why. And if you've seen Gabe Shaughnessy's, a person I talked to, a fellow member of the Milwaukee Astronomical Society, if you see his Astrobin page, you will understand why I love astrophotography so much, because he is very talented. With the advent of photography and the evolving accessibility of distant cultural trade, the nationalism of art began to vanish. With many newer movements, the origins of the movement can be attributed only to a variety of cultures, not a single culture. For a variety of cultures contributed to the advent of that movement, this becomes especially plausible in contemporary art movements. These two episodes will cover the many quickly evolving and brilliantly complex movements from the Romantic movement to contemporary art, as in art in the last half century. Romanticism originated in Europe near the end of the 18th century as a counter to neoclassicism. We know about neoclassicism because of podcast episode 54, so if you want to look into that, I definitely implore you to do so. We discuss neoclassical art as the final section. Romanticism peaked around 1800 to 1850, and was characterized by its chasm with neoclassical art that would later cause the two movements to subdivide into effectively every future art movement. Romanticism was far more than a movement in art. There was romantic literature that featured novelists and poets that continue to captivate millions, myself included, today, such as the poems of Edgar Allan Poe and the novels of Mary Shelley, which was Frankenstein. Charlotte Bronte, I may have her name incorrect because it's the E with the two dots above it, and I'm not really sure how to pronounce her last name. Charlotte Bronte. She wrote Jane Eyre. Emily Bronte, that was her sister. She wrote Wuthering Heights. And, of course, Jane Austen. I did not like reading Pride and Prejudice. But she wrote Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Mansfield Park, etc. Romantic architecture included the Royal Pavilion in Brighton, England, the Cologne Cathedral in Cologne, Germany, and the Hameau de la Reine in Versailles, France. Of course, Romanticism was present in visual arts as well, because we are talking about it in an episode on visual arts. Romanticism began in landscape painting, where artists began to create dramatic, wild scenes, such as in The Bard, a work of the artist Thomas Jones that combined Romanticism and Welsh nationalism. It's a really brilliant, but still a very tenebrous painting. From the top of my head, I can remember it. Romanticism also had a mystical touch, indicating a shift from classical art to an entirely new form of artistic expression. Romantic art also challenged common ideals in art. For example, the works of John Constable challenged the belief in the hierarchy of genres. It was a formulation that ranks different genres of an art form based upon their cultural and historical value. And they generally put landscape paintings, because of their low cultural and historical value, near the bottom of that ranking. So challenging that hierarchy basically meant painting landscape paintings. That's basically what it meant. Perhaps the greatest achievement of the Romantic movement was its coincidence with, coincidence, if you want to be very specific, with the paradigm shift from art commissioned for the church or the nobility to the creation of art based upon the ideas of the artist him or herself. This paradigm shift led to the rise of a tenebrous symbolism in all subsequent art. The thoughts of the artist were now to be deciphered rather than the thoughts of the church or the monarchy or the nobility. Romanticism was perhaps most prolific in its notable pieces, pieces that represented the pulchritude of such an exemplary movement. I call it my second favorite movement. I think that's behind the Renaissance. I don't know what I ranked it back then. I can't remember what I ranked it, but I'm pretty sure it was the Renaissance. That was my favorite. I loved Romanticism because my favorite painting ever is a Romantic painting. And we're discussing it now, so. The Wanderer Above the Sea of Fog by Caspar David Friedrich is my favorite piece from the Romantic era. It features a young, well-dressed man as he reaches the peak above a sea of fog, of what is likely a mountain, perhaps a mountain in the Elbe sandstone mountains in Bohemia and Saxony, which is a state of Germany. Friedrich's painting is exceptionally dramatic and grandiose, appealing to the ambition and even the wonder, or even wander, in all of us. I was going to buy a 32 or like a 24, a large canvas of it, but I decided not to. Eventually, I'm going to though. I would like to get some art in my. I would definitely like to get some art in my room. But it would be pretty nice to get individual art that was created by an artist today that exists today, right? Likely the most recognizable painting from the French Revolution in the following 50 years, which encompassed about four more revolutions, if you know what I'm talking about, 1830, or was it, I can't remember the years specifically, I know there's one in 1848, there was one, I think there's one in the early 19th century, I think it was like 1814 or something, and then I think there's one in 1830. There were a lot of French revolutions. The French was very unstable from the first French Revolution to the establishment of the long existing French Republic. But likely the most recognizable painting from the French Revolution in the following 50 years, and honestly Romanticism as a whole, Liberty Leading the People is a painting by Eugene Delacroix that commemorates the Second French Revolution and the overthrow of King Charles X. Partly recognizable as the cover of Coldplay's single Viva La Vida, Liberty Leading the People portrays a woman, Marianne. Marianne is France's goddess of liberty, wearing a Phrygian liberty cap as she holds France's tricolor flag. And tricolor flags represent republicanism, liberty, and revolution. I'm assuming each color represents one of those. A Marianne stands above the dead, who could be considered as sacrificed for liberty. A Marianne is bare-breasted, connecting the goddess of liberty with heroic nudity of classical antiquity. While romantic art did create a chasm with classical art, it still incorporated classical expressions. The Raft of the Medusa is an oil painting depicting the aftermath following an event in which 147 people on a hurriedly crafted boat were sent adrift, largely due to the, and I quote, incompetence of the captain. 132 of the 147 on the ship died as a result of dehydration and starvation. And the survivors of the ship were known to have practiced cannibalism to survive. Yeah, not the most amazing painting. The scene in the painting is epic, depicting a major storm and exceptional hardship. The painting is an iconic representation of human agony, similar to the spectacle of struggle in Laocoon and his sons, which is my favorite Greek sculpture, by the way. It's a Greek sculpture depicting Laocoon and his two sons as they are attacked by sea serpents. However, unlike Laocoon and his sons, the Raft of the Medusa depicts the agony of a real costly event. And costly as in controversial as well. The Desperate Man is a self-portrait of Gustave Courbet that depicted a man, obviously Courbet himself because it's a self-portrait, in a state of desperation. Some notable artists from the Romantic movement were Francisco Goya, Caspar David Friedrich, Eugene Delacroix, William Blake, and Radin Sala. The realist movement began in France during and after the 1848 revolution, yet another French revolution that abdicated a monarchy. The 1848 revolution formed a new French republic, the French Second Republic, which would last for only 3 years until it too fell. In 1851, a coup that turned France into an authoritarian empire until 1870 fell upon France, dissolving the French Republic and French democracy for 18 years. So they had a very stable democracy. The style of realism is as self-explanatory as any movement's name can possibly be. Art from the movement was realistic. Realism attempted to represent subjects truthfully, without unrealistic figures or scenes, supernatural elements, and speculative fiction. Speculative fiction is like a concept like fantasy, for they are not only fictitious, but scientifically impossible. Some notable works include The Thinker, which is one of Auguste Rodin's greatest sculptures, and either my first or second favorite sculpture of his. It is up there with The Kiss. The Thinker, originally a relief in Rodin's Gates of Hell, it actually used to be the poet, because it was named after Dante Alighieri, the poet who wrote Inferno and the Divine Comedy and Paradiso and all that. It depicts a sitting nude male. It's technically heroic male nudity, but not a choros, for choros depicts a standing nude male as he is thinking. The man certainly is in the midst of a deep philosophic thought, but upon seeing The Thinker for the first time myself, I felt the subject to be depressed or despondent, for his physical comportment conveyed a looming heartbreak almost, or even loss. This is, of course, in my mind, considering the name of the sculpture is The Thinker. My analysis is not accurate, however, it appeals to me. We will see more of Rodin's artistic ingenuity in these two episodes. The Stonebreakers is another Gustave Courbet, painting. Courbet was present in Romantic art as well. The Stonebreakers depicts two peasants undergoing hard labor. Courbet intended the painting to address the laborious everyday life of commoners. The painting was destroyed during the Second World War, so it doesn't exist. You can't see it anymore. October is a painting by Jules Bastien Lepage, depicting a woman as she harvests potatoes. October, harvest. The work stood out to me because of the detail in the subject's face. It was just exceptional. absolutely beautiful, for one can easily consider the subject a real person through that painting. October is one of many realist works that depict peasants in their toil. Martine à Villeneuve, or From Water's Edge, is a landscape painting featuring a forested area that opens up to a small lake or river. This painting, created by Henry Biva, is extremely detailed and realistic, very similar to pencils. The painting was created en plein air, or en plein air. I'm not going to try to be French, or just it was painted outside, with a scene gazed at by the painter while he painted. Some realist artists included Gustave Courbet, Edouard Manet, Ilya Repin, and Edward Hopper. And of course, it's modern art, so we have to include Impressionism, and we also have to include Post-Impressionism, so there's a lot of Impressionism. Impressionism began in Paris, France, with the rise of a group of Impressionist artists in the late 1870s and 1880s. The name Impressionism originated from a work of Claude Monet. It's called Impression Sunrise. It's very, very popular. Impressionism was characterized by thin yet visible brushstrokes, the stress of an accurate depiction of light, movement, odd visual angles, and ordinary subjects. Impressionism relaxed the distinction between the subject and background, creating paintings that assembled snapshots. These snapshots captured what felt like features of a greater, not a whole, reality. Several techniques distinguished Impressionism from other modern art movements. These techniques included short, thick strokes of paint that were used to accentuate the essence of the subject, the combination of colors, that was very rare. And instead, Impressionists applied colors side by side to create simultaneous contrast. There were also complementary colors mixed to produce a grayscale color that were combined to produce dark tones. They also used the style of aya prima, or alla prima, or wet on wet, a technique of placing wet paint onto wet paint without allowing prior applications of paint to dry. This was used by Impressionists to produce softer edges and intermingled colors. They also used to apply paint on a white or bright surface. They paid close attention to the reflections of colors from objects from object to object, often producing dark, shadowy scenes. And then the biggest thing is the painters worked in plein air. They worked outdoors, allowing them to create scenes that produce a brilliant effect of bold shadows, which projected freshness previously not represented in painting. Obviously, it's Impressionism, so there are probably quite a lot of works, and there indeed were. And of course, we must not forget Claude Monet in this. Impression Sunrise is Claude Monet's most famous painting, and it's probably perhaps even Impressionism's most famous painting. It depicts the point of Le Havre. It might be La Havre, at sunrise, with two rowboats and the red sun as the focal points. Monet's Impression Sunrise shies away from idealized, grandiose landscape portraits, striving instead for individualism and, of course, Impressionism. Impression Sunrise is credited as the painting that founded Impressionism, including its name. The woman with a parasol, or Madame Monet and her son, is another Monet painting, which depicts Monet's wife, Camille Monet, and their son, Jean Monet, while they lived in Argentile, France. I hope that's correct. Argentile, France. The work captures a windy moment occurring during a family stroll. It's not windy, it's windy, to be very exact. The work captures the essence of Monet, of course. It is one of my favorite Monet paintings, in my opinion. It's one of my favorites, certainly. I liked it way more than I liked Impression Sunrise. Camille Monet holds an umbrella as she faces the painter, or technically the viewer. Behind Camille is Jean, Camille's son, who stands, and of course Monet's son as well, who stands a few feet behind her, and Jean is staring at the painter like his mother. La Grenouillère La Grenouillère, I'm not completely sure if I said that right, is a painting by Pierre-Auguste Renoir featuring the Camembert, a small island with a single tree which links to the Grenouillère. Let's just say it's that. I'm sure it probably is around that anyway. It is a floating restaurant in Bougival, or Beaujeval, France, a commune around 21 kilometers from Paris. The luncheon of the boating party, by Pierre-Auguste Renoir, is a painting depicting a group of Renoir's friends while they relax on a balcony at the Fournay. A restaurant west of Paris. The scene is very bright and lively. I can picture it in my head right now, communicating the event's warm atmosphere. The Pfeiffer is a painting by Edouard Manet that features a boy as he plays the flute. Behind the flutist is a monochrome background, which works to frustrate attempts in drawing, through the painting, the size and the importance of the subject. The Kiss is a sculpture by Auguste Rodin, perhaps my favorite Rodin work. I've seen it. I've seen one of the casts. I've also sat next to the Thinker, and apparently this is a very popular thing because one of the teachers in my high school did the same thing. But apparently a lot of people like to emulate exactly what the Thinker, or the poet, you could say, is doing. So I'm actually doing that right now. You can't see it because I don't have a camera. I don't have a camera. This is a podcast. But you can understand the gist of it. So a lot of people try to emulate that, and they take pictures with it. I actually did myself with my cousin when I was at the Baltimore Museum of Art. And The Kiss is another one of Rodin's sculptures that became very widely popular. It's both at the BMA, the Baltimore Museum of Art, and at the Milwaukee Art Museum. It depicts a man, of course, and a woman, of course, kissing. The sculpture, once a relief in the Gates of Hell, a monumental bronze sculpture intended to be a museum portal, features a tender, beautiful, and romantic moment that appeals to the emotions of the sculpture's viewers. It is a very, very, very emotional sculpture. In a field in Argenteuil, France, two of Claude Monet's most cherished people, his wife and his son, Camille and Jean, stood in a poppy flower field. You might know where I'm going with this if you are an art nerd. One of Monet's most recognizable paintings, Wild Poppies Near Argenteuil, captures a vivid, beauteous French landscape, reminding us of the short time we have every year to witness the flowering of nature's most evocative, brilliant spectacle. And this is, of course, the flower blooms, the blooming season. That's my favorite time of the year. Impressionism highlighted the talent of many artists, but a few stood out among the standouts, including Claude Monet, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, Edgar Degas, Edouard Manet, Auguste Rodin, and Henri Matisse. Symbolism began in France, Belgium, and Russia in the late 19th century. Rejecting naturalism and realism, symbolism sought to represent absolute truths through metaphor, whether in painting or literature. We have a very succinct description of symbolism, because symbolism is what symbolism was. The movement was symbolism. It was just symbolism. But the movement was essentially the rebirth of romanticism, rejecting the rejection of romanticism. Yeah, that's basically what it is. So it rejected the rejection. So two opposites, two negatives. Adding two negatives makes a greater negative, but let's say you have 8 minus negative 8. There you go, 16. That's basically what I'm implying. The Crying Spider is, we're going to go to the notable works. The Crying Spider is a charcoal sketch by Odilon Radon. It's just one of the weirdest things, one of the weirdest sketches I've ever seen, but it's very interesting. It is a symbolist painting from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The Crying Spider, while arguably the most recognizable work from symbolism, is extremely disconcerting, extremely unnerving, and extremely horrifying. The sketch features a spider with a human head, and this human head is very sad, and hence the name Crying Spider. With the body of a spider, but the face of a despondent human, the sketch implores us to see through the monster and empathize with the monster's heart. The Young Woman on the Shore, also known as The Young Woman on the Beach, is a painting by Edvard Munch, featuring, of course, a young woman on the shore. And Edvard Munch wrote, painted another extremely famous painting that will be featured later in this, in the next episode. And I mean, if you know what I'm talking about, you do know what I'm talking about. It's one of the most recognizable paintings that exists. And this is just a complete allusion to it. But the young woman, the subject of the painting, has blonde hair and wears a beautiful blue dress. With a peaceful demeanor, the woman faces the water away from the painter or the observer. I absolutely love this painting. It's one of my favorite paintings ever. The next one is also one of my favorite paintings ever. The last notable work I listed from symbolism was The Kiss. Not Rodin's Kiss, not Auguste Rodin's The Kiss. It was Gustav Klimt's The Kiss. This is my, I would say this is my second favorite painting ever. It is an oil painting of a couple, of course, kissing. The painting created in 1907 or 1908 depicts a couple embracing each other as they are entwined in a beautiful robe. It's a very golden picture. They use gold leaf paint, so yeah. The man in the scene, who is featured on the left with his face pointing away from the viewer, kisses the cheek of the woman who is facing the viewer from the right side of the painting. It's a very vulnerable moment, you could say. It's a very vulnerable and extremely emotional moment. You can feel just you can feel the love, you could say, in a way. Some of the symbolists from the symbolism movement include Gustav Klimt, Edvard Munch, Gustav Moreau, and Paul Gauguin. And we will see more of Gauguin. I think it's Gauguin. But yeah, understand that I always mispronounce names because I don't speak French yet. So I apologize in advance. As planned, there will of course be two parts to this single technical episode. Thank you all for listening, and as always, have a good morning, afternoon, evening, and night. Take care, and stay curious.